you. Hi, everyone. I will start off with an apology. I realize that my blazer matches exactly this backdrop, and so if I look like a floating head, you've heard my apology. I am excited to talk with you guys today about GPA management in 2024, and thank you guys for inviting me back. All right, so these are my disclosures. Those of you who have heard me speak before, I always start with a case. So, 38-year-old female is brought to the ambulance, or brought by ambulance to the ER after coughing up blood at home with increasing confusion. She has sinus pressure drainage, treated with multiple courses of antibiotics intermittently over the past couple of months. She, on exam, is tachycardic, has a low-grade fever, sitting 80% on 4 liters. She's got crusting, nasal ulceration, crackles on pulmonary exam. Also has 2+ pitting edema. She's unable to converse regularly due to confusion and dyspnea. She's intubated for respiratory distress. So not doing well. Her labs show leukocytosis, anemia, elevated inflammatory markers. Her creatinine's 3.4. Her urine shows red blood cells and 2 grams of protein. Her CANCA is positive. Her PR3 is highly positive. Her GBM antibody is negative. Remember to check that in people with pulmonary renal syndromes because they're treated differently. Renal biopsies, pending. And her CT chest and MRI brain are pictured here. This is not difficult to kind of figure out what she has going on. So she has GPA. Which of the following, this is the first audience response question, carries the highest weight or most points in the new classification criteria for GPA? Nasal crusting, sensory neural hearing loss, PASI immune, glomerulonephritis on biopsy, or a positive test for PR3. Okay, so glomerulonephritis on biopsy or a positive test for PR3. It looks like the biopsy is kind of winning out here. All right, so these are actually the 2022 ACR ULAR classification criteria. And this is a major important update from the 1990 criteria, which one of the big differences is that these are weighted criteria. And so you get a different amount of points. But the thing I want to really point out here is that classification criteria, I've said this before, is to include people in clinical trials. It is not diagnostic criteria. And so when you look at this, these points, actually, it's really once you've ruled out other mimics of vasculitis and also are trying to differentiate between the different small vessel vasculitides. So you can see here actually that you get positive 5 points for the PR3 or CANCA antibody. So that actually has the highest weight, followed by the nasal crusting, because those are really classic features for GPA that might help differentiate it from some of the other vasculitides. All right, so another question. How do you want to treat this patient? Pulse steroids plus Cytoxan and plasmapheresis with a 4-month glucocorticoid taper, Rituxan, plasmapheresis, and a little bit of a more prolonged glucocorticoid taper, rituximab, avacopan with a 4-week steroid taper, Cytoxan and rituximab with a 4-month glucocorticoid taper. A majority is going with rituximab, avacopan, and a 4-week glucocorticoid taper. So all of you are right. So that's nice. There is data out there to support all of these regimens that I put up there. I just have up here the ACR guidelines and the ULAR guidelines, and I just want to point out a couple of recommendations from these guidelines and differences between the two. So for induction therapy in severe disease, the ACR recommends rituximab over Cytoxan. ULAR says you can use either rituximab or Cytoxan. In relapsing disease, rituximab is preferred. In non-severe disease, we say use methotrexate. ULAR says use rituximab. This patient has severe disease, so that doesn't specifically apply. Glucocorticoids. Both societies recommend a reduced glucocorticoid pexivas regimen, and we will get into that a little bit later. And in terms of plasma exchange, the ACR recommendations are against plasma exchange in whether they have renal involvement or alveolar hemorrhage. ULAR says you can consider it in renal involvement, but don't use it in alveolar hemorrhage. All right, so when this person is in front of you, they're sick, they're really not doing well, you want to throw the kitchen sink at them, right? So what do you have in your kitchen sink that can try to get this disease under control? First thing we have, that's different than what I thought. All right, 1 second. So the first thing that we have is pulse steroids. There's no good head-to-head data comparing pulse steroids with high-dose oral steroids. I tend to use pulse 1 gram a day for 3 days in my sick hospitalized patients. The other thing we have in our kitchen sink is rituximab and cyclophosphamide. We know cyclophosphamide has been around since the introduction by Fauci and Wolf in the 1970s, and we know that there's a lot of toxicities with using long-term cyclophosphamide, but it is effective. And that has been partially or largely replaced for induction with rituximab, and that's largely based on the RAVE and rituximab trials. So again, cyclophosphamide, oral and IV, both are effective. There's a little bit more leukopenia with oral Cytoxan. And rituximab, importantly, use rituximab plus two doses of cyclophosphamide and compare that to cyclophosphamide alone. And that was in a sicker population. The RAVE trial was a cleaner in that it only used rituximab and compared it to Cytoxan. But these patients didn't have a creatinine greater than 4, and none of them were on mechanical ventilation. So those are just some caveats. But all of these are possible options. Now, what about cyclophosphamide and rituximab? So that's really heavy duty, wiping out someone's immune system, right? But this study kind of went back at those three trials I just mentioned and kind of looked at whether how patients did. If they got just rituximab, if they got the combination of rituximab and Cytoxan, or they just got Cytoxan. And what you can see here is overall, the patients did about the same. Again, you're going across different trials, so there's some issues there. But rituximab was actually slightly superior to the combination therapy in GPA patients. Now, this was a trial specifically looking at the combination of these two drugs. They gave Cytoxan up front, rituximab a week later. A week after that, they got Cytoxan and rituximab. And then they got this kind of like Euro-lupus low-dose Cytoxan protocol moving forward. So a lot of immunosuppression. These patients were sick. You can see the GFR. Half of them were on dialysis. Half had alveolar hemorrhage. All of them received plasmapheresis. And they did quite well, but there was prolonged B-cell depletion, low rates of relapse. I personally do not use this combination regularly. There's a handful of cases where I probably used a combination up front, but it is an option. All right, so we're moving on to plasma exchange. Most of you are familiar with the Pexavast trial that was published a few years ago and really did inform the guidelines that I mentioned before. So these were sick patients, again, multi-center, multi-country study, a huge undertaking. And they were basically given standard therapy with cyclophosphamide or rituximab. It was dealer's choice, whatever the investigator wanted to use for induction. Then they were randomized to either get plasma exchange or no plasma exchange. Then they were further randomized to either get standard dose glucocorticoids or reduced dose glucocorticoids. Okay, so the questions that this trial tried to answer are, do we need plasmapheresis in these patients? Is it helpful? And can we get away with using a lower dose regimen of glucocorticoids? So duplex or not duplex, you can see here the primary outcome was end-stage renal disease and mortality, and there was really no difference between the people who were plasmapheresed and who did not get plasmapheresed. But when you go back and you look at this little subgroup analysis or post-hoc analysis, you can see that those who had a really high creatinine or that were on dialysis, you know, it kind of hedges towards that favoring plasmapheresis side. It crosses one, it's not significant, but it just makes you think about if there's a signal there. And in fact, a few meta-analyses came out afterwards and looked at Pexavast and MEPEX and some of the other retrospective and prospective trials and showed that plasmapheresis actually, in the meta-analysis, decreased the risk of developing end-stage kidney disease, but it didn't affect mortality, and there was more infections in patients who did get plasmapheresis. Okay, so just going on to the second part of this sort of trial, glucocorticoids. Can we get away with using less glucocorticoids? And this is just for reference. All the patients in this trial got pulse steroids up front. And in the reduced dose arm, their dose was cut in half by week 2. Not surprising, and they were tapered off. The reduced dose arm was basically down to 5 milligrams by 4 months. So not surprisingly, the reduced dose arm got less glucocorticoid exposure. There was an even amount of death and end-stage renal disease in both of these arms, and there were more serious infections in the patients on the standard dose regimen. So the reduced dose steroid regimen was as effective as the standard regimen for induction in ANCA vasculitis with less infections. This really shaped the guidelines for both EULAR and ACR, saying that we should use this reduced dose Pexavast regimen. Again, those little post-hoc analyses you can see here, there's a little bit of a signal in those patients who were on rituximab. Now that was about 15% of the patients in the Pexavast trial. And again, it crosses one, but it just makes you question what's going on there with rituximab. This was very multi-country, so again, there was less access when this trial was going on to rituximab outside of the U.S., and so there was a lot of Cytoxan induction in this trial. But, so should I always do this rapid glucocorticoid taper? So at the ACR this last year, the French came out and told us, you know, here's what we found, and it raised a lot of eyebrows, or, you know, shoulders or whatever, and people were wondering, you know, is this rapid taper safe? This is the guidelines, and should I be doing this in all my patients? Now, this was a retrospective study, and it basically was looking at the reduced dose glucocorticoid regimen from Pexavast that I just mentioned versus the standard dose, and this is real-world data, right? And they had a different composite endpoint. So they looked at death and end-stage kidney disease, but they also included progression before remission and relapse. And what they showed in terms of that composite endpoint, which is bad, is that 33% in the reduced dose arm ended up getting that composite endpoint versus 18% in the standard arm. So not really good for that reduced dose arm. Now, across the board, there was no difference in death or end-stage kidney disease. They also noted that there was no difference in serious infections, which was different than the Pexavast trial. And this reduced-dose glucocorticoid, especially in the rituximab patients, increased the risk of death and end-stage kidney disease. You can see on the image there kind of the difference between the reduced-dose arm and the not-reduced-dose arm or the standard arm. And the highest risk was those in patients who had an elevated creatinine and who were undergoing induction with rituximab. So let's just get a little bit into more detail about these two different trials and why there's maybe some differences here. We know one is a randomized controlled trial, it's highly regulated, and the other one is a real-world study. And so that's when people like stop being polite and start getting real. And so what does that information tell us about what we should do with these patients? So first of all, there was a difference in the primary outcome, right? One is end-stage kidney disease and death, and in the real-world study, they also included disease progression and relapse. Those are important things in our patients, so it is important to take those into consideration. In terms of induction, 15% got rituximab in the standard in the randomized trial in Pexavast, 71% got it in the real-world study, and all of the patients in Pexavast were given IV pulse steroids, less in the real-world study. When we think about the standard regimen, it's really standard in a randomized control trial, right? So that's per protocol. In this other study, it was a mixed regimen. They had a sort of French taper, a Courtage taper, and a Pexavast taper, so there was differences within what people were calling the standard regimen. Patient population was a little bit different, you can see here. Plasma exchange, because Pexavast was looking at the role of plasma exchange, 50% of patients in each of those arms got plasma exchange, whereas if you looked at this other analysis, only 13% got plasma exchange in the reduced dose arm, and 55% still got plasma exchange in the standard dose arm. So again, there's a lot more bias that comes into play when you have, when you're making a decision and you think the patient maybe isn't quite as sick. Maybe you choose not to pulse them. Maybe you choose not to use plasma exchange. And maybe you put them in a reduced dose arm and maybe their outcomes aren't quite as good. So there's nuances there. So what do I do with these mixed signals? I tend to induce with rituximab a gram times two. You know, when the trials were originally designed, it was based on lymphoma protocols, but 1 gram times 2 works. I consider plasmapheresis. I used to not after Pexavast, but now I think about it in my patients with severe kidney disease or who would come in on dialysis. I usually use avacopan as part of my induction regimen, so the standard versus reduced dose regimen doesn't play as much of a role for me, but if not, I generally follow the reduced dose Pexavast glucocorticoid taper. That's because guidelines are guidelines. They're to guide you, and they don't always apply for every patient. And so as I'm going down on the steroids, if someone's not doing well, then I'll adjust the dose. But I don't want to sort of jump to the other side just because of this other sort of abstract that was presented at the plenary at ACR. So in which of the following scenarios would you start avacopan? PR3 relapsing patient with severe disease, a GPA patient with worsening disease activity on prednisone less than 15 milligrams daily, limited GPA patient with refractory nasal crusting, or I don't use avacopan. Okay. Interesting. So a couple of mixes across the board. This is a very beautiful, I don't know, example of mouse studies translating into therapies for patients, right? So we know historically from mouse studies that if you inject a mouse with MPO-IgG, they develop a glomerulonephritis that looks exactly like ANCA vasculitis, right? But if you block the interaction between C5 and its receptor, or C5A and its receptor, either by blocking C5A or blocking the receptor or knocking out the mouse, And then you take MPO-IgG and inject that mouse. They are protected from developing this glomerulonephritis. So this kind of translated into the CLEAR and CLASSIC studies looking at avacopan, which is a C5a receptor blocker, to see if there was efficacy and safety in using this medication. And it kind of led to this phase 3 trial, the ADVOCATE trial, which again, many of you are familiar with. And in this trial, they gave patients, you know, regular standard of care induction with Cytoxan. Those patients were given azathioprine for maintenance or rituximab. The rituximab arm did not get maintenance therapy. And they randomized to either get avacopan 30 milligrams twice a day or a prednisone taper over a period of 20 weeks. And so the clinical endpoints here, what they found was that avacopan was non-inferior to glucocorticoids in terms of remission at 26 weeks and was actually superior at 52 weeks. Not surprisingly, there was less glucocorticoid toxicity in patients who were not in the glucocorticoid arm. In terms of improvement in kidney function, the avacopan was non-inferior to the standard glucocorticoid arm, and numerically you can see that there were some improvements. Adverse events were similar in both arms, and health-related quality of life was better in the avacopan group. Sorry, these slides got a little bit messed up. So post-hoc analysis, I mentioned in the other trials where post-hoc analysis kind of gives you some signals or some worry. There was some post-hoc analysis presented at ACR this year, and you can see when they looked at subsets of patients with renal involvement or even significant renal involvement, like a GFR less than 20, there was actually no difference in terms of the efficacy of this medication. Patients with alveolar hemorrhage also reflected the original trial. When you just looked at the patients treated with rituximab, there was no differences. And also when you looked at a subgroup of patients who were elderly, more than 65, it mirrored the general trial results of the ADVOCATE study. So it didn't show any new, very concerning signals in some of these post-hoc analyses. Back to the real world. So this is some real-world data that was presented, again, at ACR this year. And in the original trial, patients were, you know, brought down off of steroids, and the goal was to try to bring them off over about a period of 4 weeks. People did different things in the actual trial, but that's kind of what I tend to try and do is taper them down over a period of 4 weeks. But I usually keep them on 5 milligrams as my own practice for a little while. Anyways, in this real-world study, you can see that patients were decreasing their prednisone pretty quickly. And by 8 weeks, about half of the patients were off of prednisone. But even up to 24 weeks, there were still about maybe 20% of people who were still on steroids. And the mean dose here was 10 milligrams a day. So it was showing an improvement in terms of people coming down off prednisone, but they were still on some prednisone at, you know, pretty far out from induction. And these are the two biggest kind of abstracts that discussed the real-world use of avacopan. And you can see here, I just highlighted some of the things that surprised me. I tend to use, like I said, rituximab for induction. In most cases, but about half of the patients were actually induced with a combination of rituximab and Cytoxan. Again, a combination that I don't use very often at all. Maybe this is because partially this is going to be prescribed by our nephrology colleagues and they have trouble letting go of Cytoxan, so maybe they just want to use a little bit of both. I'm not sure, but my husband's a nephrologist, so I'm allowed to say that. But really, rituximab and Cytoxan, that was a pretty high use of combination therapy. The other thing was in terms of time to discontinuing glucocorticoids. At 8 weeks, 45% remained on glucocorticoids in one of the study I just showed you. At week 26, 8% were still on glucocorticoids. There were differences in terms of the rates of clinical remission, but there was still good, you know, renal signal in Sebastian's study. Something that was interesting was that most patients were started on this drug as an outpatient, and there were some insurance barriers. The other thing is that avacopan was started in Sebastian's study eight to nine weeks after glucocorticoid initiation. Now, in the trial, you use avacopan up front right when you start the steroids, and I don't know if this is because of access on the inpatient side or people not really waiting till they follow up with the patient and then deciding to prescribe it and then adding it on. So that will lead to delays, obviously, in bringing down the glucocorticoids. But again, so this is how in real life they're not always using it the way that it was done in the trial, and there are ways to get the drug sooner for your patients. But it looks like patients were starting it about 2 months after they were actually getting induced. What about infections? PJP prophylaxis. Okay, so this is like registry health claims, actually a health claims database analysis. Now, it looked at over 900 patients with GPA, and they were all getting rituximab, and they were followed for about 500 days. And actually only 30% of these patients were on Trimethoprim sulfa prophylaxis. That's a lot less than I kind of expected. I know that we worry about some of the side effects with trimethoprim sulfa. We know that inhaled pentamidine is a real pain to try to set up, and so maybe people are just not using it as much. But in GPA patients, I tend to really think about using some sort of prophylaxis, and that's probably because PGP pneumonia can kill you pretty easily. So in this registry or claim database, 13 patients did develop PGP. All of the patients who developed PJP were not on prophylaxis. But the interesting thing that they found was that there was a decrease in serious infections by half and a decrease in outpatient infections overall, and that includes largely pulmonary infections and sepsis in the patients who were getting trimethoprim sulfa prophylaxis. There were some increase in adverse events. So basically, for every serious infection avoided, 2 to 3 patients will experience an adverse event from trimethoprim sulfa. Now, I tend to really use this medication, especially up front, till I get the prednisone down. And in patients who have underlying lung disease, a really severe sinonasal disease, I will keep patients on prophylaxis long term, especially if they have underlying GPA. So we induce our patient with rituximab. We give her plasmapheresis. We give her IV glucocorticoids, avacopan. Wean her prednisone over 6 weeks. We start PJP prophylaxis. She does well. When you see her in follow-up at 3 months, she wants to know what the maintenance regimen will be. And here's a couple of options for you. Rituximab, 500 every 6 months for 5 years. Rituximab, 1 gram every 4 months for 2 years. Azathioprine, 2 mg/kg/day for 5 years. Rituximab, 1 gram every 6 months for 2 years, and then switching over to tailored dosing, meaning based on clinical signs of disease activity, relapsing, or B-cell repopulation or ANCA titers going up. Okay, so it looks like most people who are voting here are saying 1 gram every 6 months for 2 years and then using tailored dosing followed by the 500 milligrams every 6 months for 5 years. All right, that's interesting. So in terms of maintenance of remission, I agree with both of those as definite options. The Mainritzen 1, 2, and 3 trials kind of gave us a lot of information about how we can maintain remission in these sick patients. And the Mainritzen 1 trial really showed that rituximab is superior to azathioprine in terms of keeping people in remission, and there was long-term follow-up showing that. Now, the ideal dose is not 100% clear. The Mainritzen trials used 500 milligrams every 6 months. Ritazarum, which is an extension of the rituximab study, used 1 gram every 4 months. But the Mainritzen 2 trial looked at that 500 every 6 months and basically said, if we give it to you up front every 6 months, 500 milligrams versus only giving you a dose when you have, like I said, either a relapse or you have B-cell repopulation or your ANCA titers go from negative to positive or significantly increase, there were differences in the relapse rates. And remember, when someone relapses, you have to go back in and start all over. And there's not only the damage that happens from that inflammation and their flare, but you're also re-exposing them to all of these medications and heavy-duty drugs and side effects. So that difference in relapse rate is significant. And then the Mainritzen 3 trial looked at, if you do this fixed dosing, which is what's recommended for those first, every 6 months for the first 2 years, then what happens? Can you stop it? So they looked at, continuing it or giving you placebo. And not surprisingly, the patients who were on placebo flared more than the patients who stayed on rituximab. So how should you maintain remission in 2024? This is sort of looking at a combination of all of these, Mainritzen trials. And the real take home from here is that when patients were either given initial tailored dosing, so they got just induced with rituximab and then were only treated with that tailored type of regimen, or when they were given azathioprine as their maintenance, they didn't do well. There was higher relapses. Both of the other protocols, which is what all of you answered anyways, rituximab fixed dosing for 18 months or 5 years were important in terms of significantly decreasing that relapse risk. Now, if you are going to do remission, trying to keep them in remission with fixed dosing for 2 years, another question that I sometimes get is, should I dose it when the ANCA increases, whenever anything happens, when the B-cell returns, or what should I kind of do with this, years 2 to 5 and onward? And this was a study that looked at, dosing it based on ANCA return or B-cell return. And you can see that when you dose right when the B cells start to repopulate, there were less clinical relapses within 3 years. Those patients did end up getting a higher number of overall rituximab infusions. And across both sides, there were serious infections were the same, but there was more COVID-19 in the B cell dosing arm. We know the role of rituximab and its intersection with COVID-19 and how to vaccinate. And so there was a lot of sort of spacing this stuff out and doing different types of dosing regimens during the pandemic. I, like I said, tend to do definitely 2 years up front. I'll often do a gram for the first maintenance dose, then I switch over to 500 milligrams if they're doing well. I am a little bit more on the conservative side. I tend to keep my patients as long as they're not getting totally depleted of their immunoglobulins and getting major infections and they're tolerating the infusions. I'll keep them on some sort of maintenance therapy for 5 years before switching over. So rituximab and cyclophosphamide are both effective for induction in severe GPA and should be followed with fixed rituximab dosing of at least 500 milligrams every 6 months for at least 2 years. Plasmapheresis generally should not be used, but may be effective in preventing progression to end-stage kidney disease in patients with a high creatinine or on dialysis at presentation. Rapid glucocorticoid tapering may not be suitable for every single patient, as you might want to think a little bit twice with high creatinine and rituximab induction, but we really need more confirmatory data. That was an abstract that was presented, and we need to get more information about that. And like I said, in the large randomized trial of Pexavast, that wasn't the case, and so I still use a rapid taper for the most part. Avacopan is significantly steroid-sparing with reassuring efficacy in specific subgroups, and trimethoprim sulfa can help decrease PJP as well as other infections in GPA patients, but side effects are still an issue. I'd like to thank my fellows who are always asking me really hard questions, my patients who are always asking me harder questions, and my mentors, some of which are in the room and going to be speaking right after me. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from Room Now Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for Room Now Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of Room Now Live 2025.